more will be coming in, if you don't mind that, Glenn, that there might be someone coming in, but we'll get started in four. My name is Sharon, and I serve the village as an education lead, and it's my pleasure to introduce Glenn Jordan from Northern Ireland. I first met Glenn over Skype on St. Patty's Day. I mean, arranged it any better, couldn't we, to kind of help him get started in getting his plants to come to Zipover. So we are thrilled that he is here, and he is going to help us reimagine parts of the Bible. Okay, thank you.
Afternoon, everybody.
Good
afternoon. Why aren't you in the school?
Hear you.
We get it so rarely back at home that whenever it appears, we stay outdoors until all hours. Mm-hmm. So I can't imagine staying indoors on a beautiful day like this. But I'm really glad you're here. Otherwise, I'd be wasting my time. Mm-hmm. Can everybody hear me? Is that okay?
No?
Well, you're stuck. I'll shout because I have no idea what to do with anything back there.
Peg will help you with that point. So, good.
Good. I'm not going to make any apologies whatsoever for the way I speak. My accent is a curious mixture of Northern Ireland and Southern Ireland. I'm from a town just south of Dublin, but I've lived, we were calculating it just the other day, I've now lived more than half my life in Northern Ireland, and so my accent is a...
There you go. Good. I usually have people to do this for me. It's kind of... yes, I make no apologies because as the cliche of it all is, you people have accents and I speak English. And but I hope you can understand enough. We do have a tendency to speak very quickly. So if I'm speaking too quickly and you're struggling to keep up wave or something, and I'll assume you're not looking for medical assistance and we'll slow down. I haven't been here before. This is all new to me, and I have felt so welcomed as a good Irish Presbyterian of the Reformed tradition. I have felt enormously welcomed amongst the Lutherans, and I know my Presbyterian brothers and sisters back home would be very thankful that God made you, and they'd also be very thankful that God made us right. I'll not tell them. What I want to do today is, and we're going to see how far we get, because I want your involvement as well, is to look at how we read the Bible, how we read it as story, and how important stories are for how we live into that story and how we live out of the story of the text. Because we all do that. We all live in some kind of a story or stories. And tomorrow night, actually, this is like a promotion. Tomorrow night, Sharon has got me doing a reading. And I've never done a reading before, but I'm doing a reading. And I thought, well, in the context of stories... I'm going to take a little bit of time in that reading to introduce you through some reflective readings and writing to my family and my hometown, and so that you get a little bit of the story that I'm living in and out of. But today, I want to look at this bigger story arc of the text of our scriptures. Theologian John Shea begins his book, Gospel Light, with a poem by Rumi. And the poem is called Story Water, in which he compares a story to bath water. And he says that the bath water is heated by the fire, and when it reaches the correct temperature, you step into the bath. And the heated water connects the bather to the fire. The heated water carries messages from the fire to the human body. The water lets skin and fire meet. And he writes, Rumi writes, very few can sit down in the middle of the fire itself. We need intermediaries. Stories are the intermediaries, says Shay, between the fire of divine presence and those who wish to be warmed by it. So, here's a phrase guaranteed to bring a smile to every face in the room. Once upon a time. Once upon a time. Think about your favourite fairy tales at the moment. I've picked out a couple that I think were frequent in our house. Let me run on here. Do you know this one? Emperor's New Clothes. You tell that story over and over again. You read that story over and over again to children. What is that story about? Okay, yes, it's about an emperor who didn't have clothes. But what is the story about? What do we learn from the repetition of that story? If you can remember it. Some of you undoubtedly are grandparents and are going through these stories with your grandkids at the moment. What do we learn from the story of the emperor, the emperor's new clothes?
Speaking truth to power.
Speaking truth to power. Hey, yeah. It's
Believe everything you think.
Don't believe everything you think. Or everything people tell you. Sometimes power and arrogance can fool people, but ultimately we're going to be caught out by it and we'll stand exposed and naked, so be careful. What about this one? The little red hen. Do you know the story of the little red hen? She finds some corn and she goes to her friends and asks them to help her plant the corn, and they're all too busy. And then she nurtures it and the corn grows, and she goes to her same friends and says, will you help me harvest? And they're all too busy. Will you help me mill the wheat? No, we're all too busy. Will you help me bake the bread? No, we're too busy. Will you help me eat the bread? Oh, of course. And she says, no, I'm going to eat it myself. What do we learn from that story? Well, I think we learn at least that sometimes people are motivated by self-interest rather than kindness. And we do well to be wise to that. What about this story? The elves and the shoemaker, is that a familiar one? I'm not sure which stories are used on both sides of the Atlantic, but I'm sure they're sort of common, the common store. Sometimes, in the midst of all the nastiness, comes something valued, comes something special, and often in very surprising ways. Fairy stories are told over and over again by willing parents, and they are often the first introduction that children get to the possibility of a world outside the protective walls of their home and the family. But even as we hear the story repeated and repeated again and again, we are frightened at the same points, we are elated at the same points. The ethic inherent in the story eventually somehow mysteriously works its way and becomes part of us. In a sense, we inhabit the story as it inhabits us, and we are changed. I don't know if you know this story. This was a favourite one when our children were young. If you're, and if you are a grandparent, the story in this one is Grandpa Bear is entertaining Baby Bear for the afternoon, and he builds a tower with these blocks, and Baby Bear knocks them all down and says, again. So Grandpa Bear builds again, and the same thing happens again. And then he persuades them to move into the sand pit, and they build sand castles, and he knocks them all down, and he says, again. And he knocks them again, and then they go somewhere else and they play, and it's again. And then Grandpa Bear by this time is exhausted, and he persuades Baby Bear that they should have a bear nap. And they climb into the hammock together. And when they get into the hammock, Baby Bear gives Grandpa a Baby Bear hug. And Grandpa Bear says,
again.
And it's a lovely, lovely story. Virtually every, I just put that in because I love it. And because as I told it to our children when they were tiny, it brings a tear to my eye now to look back. Our kids are all grown. But there's something in that endless repetition of story that, you know, just gets down deep inside us. As I said, every tradition, every human civilization has a story tradition. This is, how many people have been to Ireland? Did you see the, any, did you get to see any of the crosses? These are relatively rare, I guess, on the island, but these are story crosses. These can be enormous big things, you know, 15, 20 feet high. And the experts reckon that, let's imagine this is a, there's a church here, and about a, you know, maybe a mile distance from the church in a circle around it, they would build these huge crosses at regular intervals. And then the experts would carve into the faces of the cross Bible stories. And then they would paint them, and they would be these glorious, enormous, colorful features on the landscape. And what they reckon is that in an era before this, we're talking in the first millennium here and early in the second millennium. They reckon in a pre-literate age, the local people would, on specific days, would gather for a liturgy. They would gather at the first one, and their religious leaders would tell them the stories on the faces. And then they would all move to the next one and do it again all the way around. And in this way, they were catechized, and they learned the Bible stories. It really is quite extraordinary. It's not this one, but there's one down in the Midlands of Ireland, and they're all gospel stories, all miracle stories of Jesus, including the loaves and fishes. And the fish on the story panel, so it'll be one of these story panels, the fish are actually here. And remember, this is central Ireland, the centre of Ireland, are fish that only live in North Africa. And they are carved into the face of a stone standing cross in Ireland. And that's because they reckon there were trading routes from the coast of Ireland down along the coast of France and Spain and on down into North Africa. And both, they were trading routes, but they were also because the early Christian church was so strong in North Africa, they traded bishops back and forth in those days as well. So obviously somebody who had spent some time in North Africa came back to Ireland and carved into the stone. But they told the stories in these visual representations, and they are now a hugely impressive part of the Irish landscape. The first of these story traditions is always oral, and the storyteller is this revered member of the community. In his book, A Way of Being Free, Ben Oakry writes about storytellers, and he says, in a world where darkness held unfathomable mysteries and was inhabited with fear and dread, the people who kept the terrors at bay were the storytellers. The storytellers enabled people to sleep at night. And they wrestled with the mysteries of the dark and the terrors that were there, and they transformed them into myths and fables which coded the world and helped people make sense of it. The darkness that was a dangerous beast that consumed the unsuspecting was tamed by the storyteller. Over time, the storyteller's art changed, and instead of producing a spell or an incantation to keep the dark at bay, they became the living repositories of the living folk memory of the people. So the storytellers were so valued that the kings employed them to record the history and tell the story of the tribe or the nation. They knew the causes of things. They knew how things worked. They knew the healing properties of plants and herbs. They were the wise ones, the ones who remembered and kept alive the tradition, as well as the truest dreams and aspirations of the people. In a very real way, the storytellers kept a civilization alive. So long as the stories were remembered, the people lived on. Okri says, in our age, with certainties collapsing all around us, with no beliefs by which to steer our ways through the dark and descending nights ahead, I think that now we need those fictional old bards and fearless storytellers, those seers. It is precisely in a fractured, broken age that we need mystery and a reawoken sense of wonder. Now, I read that in the context of Northern Ireland as we struggle to make peace in our conflict. In peace and reconciliation studies, we say that the length of time you were involved in that conflict is the length of time it's going to take to come out of it. So whether that's 30 years or 400 years, it will take that length of time. And in a sense, what's happening, I like to think of Northern of Ireland as the kind of Hawaii of Europe. We exist off the northwest. We exist off an island off a continent and the northwest corner of Europe. And the great convulsions of culture and faith 500 years ago that began 500 years ago this year has worked its way out in Europe, but not yet in the furthest fringe of the continent, which is where we are. We're still working through that story. What about here in the US? You're a very young empire. And yet, it looks from the outside, and I confess that, it looks like this is a fractured, broken age for you too. What stories are you telling? What stories is your nation hearing? Okri says, famously, I think, to poison a nation, poison its stories. A demoralized nation tells demoralized stories to itself. Beware of the storytellers who are not fully conscious of their gifts and who are irresponsible in the application of their art. They could unwittingly help along the psychic destruction of their people. We don't need to travel too far from this place to see the results of stories told irresponsibly. The best leaders, argues Okri, are those who know the power of a story and who can change an age and turn an era around by the use of good stories and myths. Stories, he says, are secret reservoirs of values. Change the stories individuals or nations live by or tell themselves, and you change the individuals and nations. If you want to change how a nation thinks about itself, change the stories it tells itself. And if you want to poison a nation, then poison the stories it tells itself. All of our nations live by a multitude of stories. There are many narratives that weave their way in and out of our history. Sometimes some stories need to be left aside and others picked up. Sometimes it is necessary for stories to clash. What are the stories? What are the founding myths of America? We have a poet. He's dead now, but we have probably our best known poet is Seamus Heaney, and he has a poem called Bogland, and the opening line is something like, we have no big sun, we have no prairies to slice the big sun. And he compares Ireland's founding stories to America's founding stories. He says, your story is defined by the prairie. Whenever you were rubbing up against one another and things were uncomfortable, you moved west. And you moved west and you moved west until you could move no more. Ireland, so you are defined by space. And now in your maturing as a nation, maybe you've run out of space. Ireland's story as a nation is defined by bog and by the layers of a bog. Things that fall into a bog are covered over by the vegetation and preserved sometimes for thousands of years. It changes the composition, perhaps, the chemical composition, but it preserves. We preserve our history in layers and we can't get away from it because it's always there. You have always had space to move into. And now maybe you don't. What is the myth? What is the story you are living by? And if it is a poisonous one, if it is a destructive one, how do you counter that story? Do you counter that story by using the same chapters and verses as the one that you are told, just tell it stronger? Or is there a way of subverting that story and telling a new one? That to me is what the gospel is about. It is always a story which subverts the dominant story that we tell ourselves. I know I'm in a very privileged position here to be standing at the front of you and lecturing about your own nation. So I'm going to step back for a moment from that. And I have got things to say and we can go through it all. It's fine. But I'm also interested to hear, and we will get some biblical material in a minute, to think how this alternative story can be shaped. But how does that sound to you? Does that make sense? Have I offended you? I apologize, but sometimes if we talk about those things, we can make something new. How does it feel to you?
I think the fact that you brought up the wide open space sort of brought about a rugged individualism in the nation's character. And as a result, I think we have a sense that we don't need each other as much as I think maybe people in small European nations realize that they need each other.
Yeah. I think you're absolutely spot on. I think Heaney got something right there, that idea of the prairie and space. Annoy me and I just move away. There's always somewhere else to go. And it has fostered, I mean, we had a young woman staying with us in our home before I left to come here. And my wife and I, you know, she's young. She's fresh into life and boundless confidence. We were astounded. our two kids don't have anything like the confidence that Rebecca has. And there is something peculiarly American about that confidence and that, you know, self-confidence. However, when that self-confidence is poisoned, okay, I'll be as blunt as, and you can forgive me. So I'll be serving your discipleship. You see it in the healthcare debate. It's an to someone from Europe, it is beyond extraordinary that as rich a nation as America cannot take care of sick people. Why should I have to pay to help those people? Let them get a job. Let them pay their own insurance. I will look after me and mine. And it is related to that. Yeah, you're right. Individualism.
Another story is that ties into that is Manifest Destiny.
Yeah. Oh, yep. You better preach that one. I won't.
Well, the myth of Manifest Destiny, when you tie that into rugged individuals, basically says I have a right to what I have, and what I have is mine. And I can get more, and everybody can get more. But the truth of the matter is, that's a complete lie. you know, in the sense that it's, you can't, when people operate on that kind of model, you have to have Indians and slavery, and you have to have the poor from China and Ireland and other places coming in to provide that labor force that allows for manifest destiny of the future.
Yeah. Yeah. So let's jump quickly then to us as a community of people of faith. What I have planned here is taking one story stream in the text of the Bible that is our part of our story. I think both of these dimensions I can see from a distance here. Where does this butt up against the Bible story? What resources in the story we're asked to live by as people of faith? Where do we butt up against these values, this dominant story? I'll give you one in a minute if necessary, but let's mine the collective resource of the group here. What are we called to live by that stands in some way alongside those stories?
Love our neighbor.
Sorry?
Love our neighbor.
Love our neighbor. Yeah. Okay. And you know, Jesus teaches us this, you know, let's dig a little bit deeper into love our neighbor. Where in the context of our biblical tradition, where do these ideas come from? Anybody? You see, Jesus didn't just pluck a saying out of the air. He was rooted in his tradition. As I said, I'll show you that in ways in a moment. And the writers of the Bible were rooted in it. Absolutely, love your neighbor. Serve your neighbor.
Servant.
Okay.
Well, it's part of its prophetic tradition, but based on law. There is both in the law and in the prophetic tradition that stream that says, love your neighbor because this is going to make sense in the long run.
Yeah. Their great calling the calling that came to Abraham was a calling to make a great nation. Who wouldn't want that? It was to make a great nation for the sake of all the nations around. So it was never to be a selfish, it was never dominance for the sake of dominance, for power for the sake of power. It was to be a light to the nations. Here is how to structure and organize a society so that As Moses says when he's given his final sermon, he says, you know, has any nation ever been blessed the way we've been blessed? We were taken out of slavery. We were protected across the wilderness. We have been brought into this good and fertile land. Has anybody ever been this blessed? So that comes with responsibilities, he says. And he gives them the law. Not to isolate them from anybody else, but to create a society, a community for the service of all the nations around. So that, he says, when they come and they ask you, as they will, how does a nation have God as close as you have? How do you do this? You can tell them the story of how he brought you out of Egypt and he led you across the wilderness and he brought you to a good and pleasant land. So that they, in their turn, will organize their society in the same way. That was the function of the law and the structures of that God gave them and the Sinai encounter. So when Jesus plucks out a statement like love your neighbor, it's because he's going right back to the absolute foundation of it all. You are a light to the nations. And it will trace it all the way back into the creation narrative as well. Steward the earth. Right from that beginning. The invitation to Adam and Eve to come and work alongside God in the tending of the garden. And it's a bit of an old chestnut now, but that idea that the Bible begins in a garden and ends in a city. That when God plants the garden and he invites the woman and the man in, you know, on the sixth day, and then on the seventh day, they rest. On the eighth day, they get going together, stewarding it, protecting it, growing it. And the end result of that work over all the centuries was intended to be, you know, this glorious millennial city that grows up around a garden in the center. It's not that they have moved from the burbs into the big city. It's that the end result of caring for creation has been the growth of this community centered around that original garden, that tree, that river. So the traditions are there, the stories we need to start recapturing and retelling. It's why I think, I'm fascinated by your sanctuary cities movement. I find that an incredibly subversive story in the context of politics today, as much for us in the UK as well as for yourselves. Here are alternative communities springing up and saying, no matter what they say, no matter what punishment they await, we are a sanctuary for those who are fleeing. Yeah, so you see, within us here, we've already spanned the story arc of the text. We know these things, but we need to find ways of telling these stories in ways that will make a difference. On Wednesday, we're going to take one direct example of what we did in Belfast, reading our Bible text and then saying, right, put this down on the street. How do we make a difference? How does it change? How do we read our text? For me, Christian discipleship is about being immersed in that story. That takes time. It also takes resources of imagination so that we begin to think and reflect on all the biblical categories and images and metaphors that shape us. I'm going to skip ahead because I think the conversation has been useful, and I'd like to skip ahead so that we can get into some of the biblical material, example of how this works. I want to take the story. If you have a Bible, you might find it interesting to turn to the book of Exodus chapter 16. And that's the story of manna. And I want maybe to suggest as an example of taking one story stream or one, how the story of manna might have continuing relevance for us to start reading it, seeing how it subverts the dominant story. Central issues in that, in the Exodus 16 account, is the fact that wilderness living was very precarious. There are no food, there are no resources, it's dangerous territory. They are surrounded on all sides by the signs of death. And yet they find, in the middle of this wilderness, God is there. And yet, they prefer slavery in Egypt. The bread of slavery in Egypt, which was certain and plentiful. And they're willing to trade that for the freedom of the precarious wilderness. There's bread, it's certain and plentiful, but there's no life or freedom there, yet they prefer that to life in the wilderness with God, the starvation of the desert, the empty and fearful place. But they find through the manna story that God is a very present help in times of trouble. Psalm 46. In the austerity of the desert, and I use that word very deliberately because that is such a hot button issue for us back home, economic austerity. In the austerity of the desert, they idealized their past in such a way that slavery in Egypt was much more attractive proposition than freedom in the wilderness. And that is that is a tough choice. Food aplenty and certain in slavery or precarious living in freedom. With some apparent frustration in his voice, God proposes to provide basic necessities for them in such a way as to impress upon them his glory. Lovely phrase in that, if you read down through, it's a beautiful phrase where it's something like, they looked into the deeper desert and that there God appeared. God's glory appeared. The lesson to them was, the manna's uncertain. You've got to get up every day, trust it every day. But the deeper glory is further on out there into the desert, not back in the place you've left. And the heavenly act of compassion comes with special instructions. Gather only what is sufficient for the day, so no hoarding. And gather twice as much on the Sabbath. The text speaks of the abundance of the resource. I will rain down bread from heaven for you. But God also speaks of the importance of restraint. Gather enough for the day and the day only. There is an implied mutuality here. Gather too much and someone else will be short. And the extra you gather will rot. It will be rottenness to you. So as you gather, bear in mind your responsibility to your neighbor. By following these simple instructions then, they would ensure that the whole community is adequately fed. Even in austerity, this story tells us, there is enough. Enough for today, and then tomorrow we'll gather again. In these straitened times, look for enough to ensure that everybody is fed. So you think about it. You think about the practicalities of it. Think about the young couple with, you know, 3, 4, 5 children who have to get up out of the tent in the morning, gather whatever receptacle they can get their hands on, train the kids up, and they all go and they gather and they gather and they gather. And mum and dad look at that and think, oh, and it's all done and the manna's gone. How on earth are we going to feed this family with just this amount? And they find miraculously there's enough. And they do it again the next day. Or what about the older couple? See, in the cold early mornings of the desert, in your tent, getting up off the ground, it's a slow affair. And by the time they're ready and they've straightened their old bones and they step out, the sun is beginning to rise. The families have been scouring the area. You've a bit further to go maybe. And it's slow picking this stuff and putting it into the 1 or 2 pots you can carry. And then you've got to get back to your tent and process it. And you think, but there's enough. And it takes faith to get out of the tent. There's enough. There is sufficient. And I look at that in the context of the austerity, economic austerity policies of the government in the UK at the moment, where we are told there isn't enough, and so those at the bottom of the economic ladder must pay the price. Or I look here and I wonder, is it really impossible for you to pay for healthcare? Really? Do we dare to make the case that there is enough? So Israel learns through manna that there are ways of life that are less risky and uncertain, but which are also the ways that lead to slavery. You hear that? Israel learns that there are ways of life less risky and uncertain, but they are the ways that lead to slavery. The only real way to live in the desert is being present to the God who promises there will always be enough. Imagine if the manna story began to shape an economic policy or a healthcare policy. Imagine. Now, we're not finished with this story because this gets told over and over and over again in Israel. And they live in this story and it shaped them and it forms them as a people so that many, many, many years later when they find themselves in slavery or in exile in Babylon and everything is hopeless and they feel starved of the presence of God, how can we sing the Lord's song in a strange land? So we hung our harps on the trees because there's no point. God is away back there and we're here. He's gone. And the prophet Isaiah sounds those, why spend your money on things that are useless? Come to me, I will give you food to eat at no cost. There will be enough, even in exile. And they learned as they remembered their story, as they lived their story, and they sought to figure out what it was to live like the people in the wilderness, they figured out that exile is like wandering. And if exile is like the wandering, God provides in exile. God provides as he did in the desert. And so the people in exile began to look for the new thing that would come. What would our promised land be like? And how will God provide for us on the journey there, here in exile? And on and on and on and on. The story continually intersects. So by the time we come to Jesus, the story is being told again in different ways. Mark chapter 6 tells a story of the feeding of multitudes. Funnily enough, on the far side of the Jordan in the wilderness. And Mark presents us with Jesus as the transformer of situations of emptiness, acting like Moses in the wilderness, providing bread and fish, and answering a central question of Israel's faith that echoes again and again and again, and echoes for us today, can God spread a table in the wilderness? It's the question of every generation. Psalm 78, verse 19. Can God spread a table in wilderness? In John 6, it's Jesus not acting like Moses this time, but Jesus as the bread of heaven. John contrasts and says Jesus is better than the bread we got in the desert. He is the gift of God who transforms hunger to fullness and death and dying into life. Eating the bread of life means accepting him and his rule and his claim over us. We participated together in the Eucharist last night. The story of the two on the road to Emmaus in Luke 24. How did they know him? In the breaking of bread. In the eating of the bread. They knew God. They knew Jesus in the food. And so on and so forth. It goes on through our text. We live in and through. So, jumping ahead. Story of manna. Of a North African community treated as nameless, threatening horde. Fleeing oppression and violence. Crossing a dangerous stretch of water on the way to the promised land. Stranded in a precarious situation of great need. Can God spread a table in the wilderness? And he does. He provides manna. Manus story number two. North Africans treated as a nameless, threatening horde, fleeing oppression and violence, crossing a dangerous stretch of water on the way to the promised land, stranded in precarious situation of great need. Are we seeing God spreading a table for Syrian refugees in Europe? Or for Mexican refugees or migrants on your southern border? Does the Manus story speak to public policy today? I'm nearly done, but as I finish up, I want to play a piece of music. Because the Manus story finds its way into my family and the family of my wife. And it comes in this particular song we're going to play from Bruce Springsteen, who is the fourth member of the Trinity. Just saying. This is a song that he released on an album that was his response to the 2008 economic collapse. This song, this is my parents' story. And it is the story of my wife's parents.
It'll happen again. Now sometimes tomorrow comes soaked in treasure and blood. Here we stood the job. Now we'll stand the flood. There's a new world coming. I can see the light. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be alright. So you use what you got, and you learn to make do. You take the home, you make it new. Find the bastards and shoot them all on sight. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be alright. I'm a jack of all trades. We'll be alright.
That is my parents today, you know, make and do after a lifetime's work. We've got to do better. And we've got to do better than the solution offered at the end of this song, which is to meet violence with violence. We've got to do better. We've got to find ways of making the Manna story live in public policy. We've got to find ways of reading our scriptures with sharp intellect and imagination and making the text live in the context of our world today. You know, I'm blessed not to have struggled in the way others do. I've more than my parents or my wife's parents did. I'm of a generation that can usually pay to make something happen rather than repair. I haven't had to fiddle with car engines as my parents or my wife's parents have, riveting doors so they don't fall apart, patching the roof, darning clothes, saving for a purchase or simply going without, and building a home where love was measured by presence with a CE at the end, rather than the purchase of stuff. But in the background of our family's stories has always been someone who held more power and threatened an existence for personal gain. There were strikes and redundancies on both sides of our families, new careers at the latter end of life. Adrian's dad made redundant in his late 50s, sitting depressed in the corner, until Christina forced him out the door to retrain as a driving instructor, which he continued to do well into his 70s. Taught me how to drive. My own dad starting a business when the factory job went bad and earning enough to keep a roof and his family, but little more. And now struggling in their retirement, getting on, just getting by. My mum and dad celebrated 57 years of marriage this year. Adrian's mum and dad celebrated 69 before her dad passed away a couple of years ago. There's never been abundance in either household, but walking a life of faith, like the miracle of manna, there was always enough. Just enough. So I see the lives of our parents, the jacks of all trades, and I celebrate their survival and their lives and their stories and say, you know, they did all right. God spread a table in the wilderness. We see it now in our own life, our personal lives, as we take choices and make choices, trusting that manna will hold true for us in our time as well. But it's not always economic. Sometimes the stories that some of you are living out of are stories of health or fractures. We live out of the manna story, God spreading a table, a healing table for us in the wilderness. The real challenge for us, I think, as people of faith, as the church, is to take those personal stories, the personal reality of God spreading tables in our wilderness, and whatever state you are on your journey now, you do have those times when God provided in a precarious situation. How do we take those personal experiences and take them out onto the streets of our nations and make our personal stories rooted in the stories of the Bible text, make them live in the places where policy is made, where decisions are taken? That we offer an alternative story to the one that dominates the narrative at the moment. Not by meeting fire with fire, but by showing that there is a different way of living. There is another story. By my watch, I've got a minute or two, but
you can go 5:30.
Well, then we've time. If anybody's interested, either in thinking about your own story, and or in us taking, well, maybe it's not manna. Maybe there's another stream of the Bible story that. There are several that we need to make live in our culture, our nations today. I've offered one. How can we read our stories in a different way and live into them in a different way? Comments, questions, reactions, applause, it's all gladly taken. Well, do you know, maybe there's a little bit of space here for us just to be quiet for a moment. And to take our personal experiences of God spreading a table in our wilderness, whatever form that wilderness has taken. And beginning in a work of imagination to begin to translate that story into the context of the street where you live, the town, community, city where you live, or even do we have the faith to imagine that that personal story of God spreading a table could become the story that our nation lives by?
Yeah, I'm thinking about, like you said, about retelling or reimagining a story. And so many times I think biblical text gets so distorted and takes us down paths that are not true to its maybe origins. I think about things that have been handed down to my family, like if you work hard, it's a sign of blessing. And that by wearing that blessing, sometimes it tips in the direction of, well, I guess you're not blessed because you're poor. So pick yourself up, dude. Make it happen. God's not with you. And I think that's a very distorted use of biblical text.
Yeah.
So how do we reimagine and reframe that story?
Eugene Peterson. Have you heard of Eugene Peterson? Good Presbyterian.
Yes.
Eugene Peterson says, and I'm going to extend it a little bit, he says that anybody who anybody who prays in public, and I'm going to extend that to say anybody who presumes to pray in public or preach in public, I suppose all preaching is done in public, must or should learn poetry. And I think that's a really interesting thing. I left out a section because it wasn't needed about the kind of tendency, I don't know if it's true in your tradition, but in the Presbyterian tradition it certainly is, that we take a biblical text and the preacher works and worries away at it for the week and then comes on Sunday morning and stands in the pulpit and delivers the interpretation of this story and how it applies. And this is the meaning today and for all time. And so the congregation leaves at the end of the service and goes home to lunch and there's nothing to talk about because the meaning has been delivered. I wonder in terms of the practice of preaching, whether preachers, we should develop the courage not to, in Presbyterian language, apply the text. Let the Holy Spirit do that. Tell the story of the text. Make, instead of parsing every word and picking it apart phrase by phrase and delivering, you don't do that with stories. The power of a story is that we, in our generation, my favorite fairy story is Chicken Licken. You know the one, the sky's falling down. And they all run along the sky in a moral panic straight into the lair of Foxy Loxy. I tell that story, but it has power because it has been told generation after generation after generation, and every generation does its own learning from it. We tend to shut story down so that it doesn't live, it has no vibrancy. And so I just think we need to get better with the text. We need to speak it more and speak about it more beautifully, actually, and make the story come alive, and then allow people, give people, trust people to make something in their context. You know, so the book, the stories come alive. I mean, it was wonderful. I stood with all of you people. I know hardly any of you. I know virtually nothing about the Lutheran tradition. And I stood with you last night and we all together recited the creed. What's the creed? It's a story. We believe in God, the Father, the Almighty, the creator of the heaven and earth and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, who was born of a virgin and he... went to the cross and he died and he was buried and he rose again and he... That's a story. It's theology in the church. It's a story. How do you tell stories? They're meant to be built upon and elaborated and the core of that story, trust the Spirit to pass on the core of, the core of the story of Chicken Licken. It gets there. Trust the Spirit to do that with the Bible text as well. That, for me, I just think we need to get better at telling the story, really, in more compelling ways than... Eddie, what do you think?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I hear that and I hear the thread of creativity and creation in the midst of that. Mm. That it's not a straight line.
I mean, what you guys are doing with Job is a really, really interesting thing with a very, very difficult text. But here's another route into the story through the art. Good. Anything else? Anybody?
Stories sometimes take time to tell.
And a lifetime. A lifetime.
And I just worry that generations are thrust into the middle of this technological world that we have now. I do worry about storytelling. We have to shorten it and shorten it and shorten it. And attention spans maybe what they should be or could be. I worry about that.
Yeah. If I push back a little bit on that, maybe it's that we're not as good storytellers as we once were. And the better storytellers are getting attention at the moment, and maybe we need to find the old cliche story of we call it a children's address, where the somebody speaks to the children on a Sunday morning, and the storyteller says, "What is small and furry and lives in trees and eats acorns and has a big furry tail?" And the little boy puts his hand up and says, "I know the answer is Jesus, but it sounds like a squirrel to me." And we know that happens in our churches. We know it happens. I do think, and kids see through that. For goodness, kids see through that. I do think training preachers. You can acquire skills of storytelling. You also have to be reading good stories. When I'm not a pastor. Nobody has ever, quite rightly, ever given me any responsibility in a congregation at all. But I've trained in theology, and when I came out of theological school, about 2 years out, 3 years out, I woke up one day and realized I haven't read a novel in years. I'm reading all these theological books. And it was coming up to Lent, and I actually took an extended Lenten fast. I wasn't going to read any theological books for a year. And that was the best part of 20 years ago now. And in the course of a year, I don't know that I read one. I finished one about 2 weeks ago, but I haven't read a theological book for years and years. I read good stories, good fiction. I read poetry, and learn how people tell stories. I do think that's really important, and how to tell a story with passion. And how to tell a story in such a way that that the hearers find their own story reflected back. We were talking about books yesterday, and I mentioned a book that I got an opportunity on. I got an invitation a couple of weeks ago onto radio, BBC Radio, to talk about three books that are spiritual but aren't religious. So three books. One of which is the most sacrilegious book I've read in a long, long time, but profoundly spiritual, in which this woman, some of you might have read Tiny Beautiful Things. I'm almost embarrassed to say I read a book which was the collected writings of an agony aunt responding to letters. So the letters are printed and then her response. But she's a professional writer. But what was beautiful was that as she was responding to the presented, if you like, pastoral problems of these people, and they were the usual ones agony aunts get, she wove in and through her beautiful writing her own story so that the person coming to her with a pastoral problem found their story mirrored back to them by the personal story in a just a beautiful way. I am not, for the purposes of the tape, that shows you how old I am, for the purposes of the recording, I am not recommending the book. It is not for everybody. But as a feat of storytelling and pastoral care, I would anybody who presumes to train for pastoral care will put that book in their hands, about how to involve your own personal story as you stand alongside those with the ordinary 21st century stuff of sex and broken relationships and grieving and loss, and why is the world so unfair, alongside some deeply, deeply moving. As I said on the radio, I said, you do not read this book in a public place. I've read it lots of times. I've got it with me here this week. I dip into it every now and again, and I was first reading it on the tube in London, tears streaming down my face. And I kind of recovered composure and got to the airport and was sitting at the gate waiting, and I was reading the next, and again, oh, it was a mess. And this woman came over to me and she said, "Are you all right, sir?" I said, "Yes, but this is just beautiful." And she said, "Strange man." But the ability to tell stories and to weave a story into our pastoral responses, I mean, just a work of real beauty and real genius. But it comes with a health warning. Holden Village is not recommending the book. It is quite graphic, and the language can be choice at times. If you can take that, if you can cope with that, you'd be in for a treat. Yeah, better storytellers. We do, and there's an event that happens. Actually, you know, things like This American Life, The Moth. You know, these are phenomenal things using technology, but telling. Sorry, if you don't know what they are. They are stories, storytelling. Everybody craves a story. And these are, you get them on podcasts. There's one that happens in Belfast called 10x9. Podrig is one of the brains behind it. Every month takes a theme and invites 9 people to tell a story about that theme for 10 minutes each. And you have to be in the queue to get into the room, into the venue, an hour or two before the doors open. People want good stories, personal stories, living stories. We've got the best. What is the film? The greatest story ever told? It's true. We need to tell it in a better way. Sorry.
I was just going to say, like, The Moth, the way that The Moth has taken off and
it's extraordinary.
Like, groups like that. I know a couple of people have started their own groups of storytelling locally and in Chicago and in Tacoma, and
yeah.
They have wine with it, you know, and it makes, but I think storytelling is, and I think the move towards podcasts is showing that people have kind of been overwhelmed by the rest of technology, and listening again to stories has become more popular.
The great podcasting phenomenons of recent time have been, you know, these ones are short, 10 minutes, 15 minute stories, but the latest ones have been extended multi-episode long stories, which I'm sure people, some in the room, will have already listened to and been astounded by. But storytelling is undergoing a renaissance, and we're a little bit behind the curve as the church, and we have a story, I think, that we need to work hard at telling, and telling in compelling ways. Yeah. Anything else? Yeah, Charles.
I don't know if you've read any Kierkegaard. I know that guy, but he was a philosopher who told stories to challenge the church, to really live into the story. And one of the images that he uses is the mirror. And he says that, you know, the scriptural story is intended to be a mirror that we can see ourselves in. And I think good stories are like that. You see yourself in the story, and it helps reflect on who you are.
Yeah.
But then he says that we, and kind of the church culture, ends up spending all their time and energy talking about the frame of the mirror. instead of actually looking in the mirror and using the mirror for its actual purpose.
Yeah.
And I think we still do that.
I teach, we call it Bible class for older teenagers in our church. And so they've graduated out of Sunday school, which is for up to 12-year-olds. And then I get them when they get 15. So I get them 15 to 18. And last year, taking this kind of thing, developed a series of Sunday school classes, Bible classes with them, titled Sunday School Stories Now That We're All Grown Up. And I'm thinking there may be some mileage in writing this up, but we went right back to the stories that you do in Sunday school. David and Goliath, Noah and the Ark, and so on, Jonah and the whale. And, you know, the first question every Sunday was essentially, before we opened a page, we said, okay, what happens in the story? And they related the Sunday school versions of that. What did they learn when they were Noah? And then, we ticked off, Jonah was running away from God. He got on a boat, there was a big storm, they threw him overboard, and, you know, the Tower of Babel. They were all disobedient, they tried to get into heaven, and God punished them by scattering them. And then we said, right, now, you're all so much older and wiser, let's read the story together, let's see what you didn't hear or see in Sunday school. And we did that. And it worked so well, I thought. I also lead a men's Bible study group once a month, and I thought, could you do the same thing with this group? So we did exactly the same program with these men. What do we remember from our youth of these stories? Now let's read them. And I have to say, when we came to Moses in the burning bush, we ended up spending 3 Saturdays, breakfast times, with the burning bush story. We're all men. We've been doing this together for 12, 15 years. So, and in that time, you know, the youngest of us is late 40s. The oldest is now 67. And we found a man, Moses, struggling with who he was in the world, struggling with his own personal identity, his family background. We found a man struggling with the classic midlife crisis. We found a man, but who still had the spark of inquisitiveness in him. Because before God speaks in the story, what the text says, he's there in the wilderness, he saw a bush that seemed to be on fire but was not consumed, and he said, I will go over and see why that bush is not being consumed. And he turns off the track he was on, and then God speaks. God did not call him. The bush was like a shiny thing dangled off the track. And God was seen to us, anyway, as we read it as men of our age, do you still have the energy for something new, to turn off that established track? And when he did, God says, right, now let's do something. Stop right there. Take off your shoes, because you're on holy ground. And I have to say, it was one of the most, those 3 Saturdays over 3 consecutive months were, I think, some of the most profound conversations about the Bible I've ever had. In men, that over the course of our 12 or 15 years together, men have been divorced, men who have lost partners, men who have lost jobs, men who have retired, men who've run that gamut of experience that we run. And the story from Sunday school is being retold, is being recast in a new age. And we need to let the stories do that. We can't lock them down into Sunday school, you know. So you read the Tower of Babel, and you read the Tower of Babel in the context of a church that is ripping itself apart. I mean, church universal, not a church that's ripping itself over inclusion issues. And we read the Tower of Babel, and we find that quite possibly the scattering that happens at Babel is not the punishment of God, but the mercy of God. Because when people gather in a circle and enclose their own type and keep out people who are different, that's dangerous for everybody. And the mercy of God was to scatter them, confuse their languages, so if they were going to survive, they needed to learn how to communicate with people who are different. They needed to find a sense of community with people who they wouldn't normally be part of. And the story, retold in a new context, reinterprets itself again, is relearned again, as we bring our imaginative resources to bear on it. That is the glory of story. And even, I mean, God forgive me, but I would find it hard to preach on Paul if you paid me. But even, again, I shouldn't have said that. This has been a bore, isn't it? But even then, even the heavy theology of Paul in Romans comes in a narrative context. He is writing into a story of stuff that's happening in Philippi. And he is responding by trying to give them some instruction about how to live in this particular context. So what is the narrative context into which he's writing to help us understand? And then to say, not that this is the way it always is, but to say, in response to this issue, this is how Paul thought. There's a school of thought. I'm an Old Testament person. That's why I struggle with Paul. But the first set of tablets that Moses came down the mountain with were written by God's hand himself. The Ten Commandments were written by God's finger, the text says. And Moses comes down the mountain carrying the two tablets of stone. And when he gets to the bottom of the mountain, before he gets to the bottom, he hears the reveling and the partying of the golden calf. They're all dancing around the golden calf. And the first thing he does, this profound moment of insight for Moses, is to take those two tablets of stones and smash them. Because he knew when he saw them with the golden calf, he knew how persistent the human instinct to idolatry is. And he says, I was only gone a short time, he says. And they said, yeah, but we didn't know when you were coming back. So in that short time, while the mountain is still shaking, and the trumpets are still blasting, and the cloud is covering, they build a golden calf. And they worship the calf. And Moses, when he gets there, realizes, I have two pieces of stone which God himself wrote. I need to smash these. Because if they get their hands on these tablets of stone, they will start to worship the writing of God, and they will lock down what God is saying on this rock. They will lock it down, and they will worship it. So he smashes it, because we're not even to make an idol of the text, which is what we do all the time. The next one, of course, slightly different, because Moses writes that one himself.
They might want to put it in their courthouses.
Yes. Yeah, we worship the text, but we do it all the time, not just in public life. We do it in the church. It's in the Bible. God said it. That's enough. But what is said in that text has come from a particular narrative storyline context. And that is the response to this context. Now, our context will be related but different. So how are we to respond in the same way? How are we to reread and in our day and make a good response to. But the story is what helps us. And we do need to just strengthen our muscles of imagination for that task. Otherwise, the easy bit is the tablets of stone. Lock it down, It'll never change. I may be speaking out of a Presbyterian context because we're suckers for that. The Reformed tradition, you know, sola scriptura and all the rest, like that is it.
Thank you.
Yes, you need to go and get something to eat. Well, thank you.